I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, before we get the show started, I wanted to let you know we're giving away a bunch of brand new Black Magic gear.
Yeah, cameras, switchers, DaVinci Resolve licenses, a bunch of awesome stuff. So stay tuned to learn how you can enter to win free gear from Black Magic, and we're going to tell you all about it later on in this episode. Now cue the music.
Hey, welcome to the 150th episode of Just Shoot It, a podcast about filmmaking, screenwriting, and directing. This episode is brought to you by patron Brian Charles Lehrer. Thanks, Brian. I'm Matt Enloe.
And I'm Oren Kaplan, and today we have Darren Lynn Bozeman and Sabrina Kern. They are the director and star of the new horror film, St. Agatha. And Darren Lynn Bozeman is, this is, he said, maybe his 14th feature film?
He's a little foggy on it, but, like, he's definitely got a...
He's done some things.
He's directed in the teens.
Saw 2, Saw 3, Saw 4. He also wrote Saw 2. He directed Repo, the genetic opera with Paris Hilton.
and a bunch of other stuff. He's a really fascinating genre director who got his start early but has found sustainability in making movies and also kind of exploring other different artistic avenues that we get into a little bit as well. So we talk about what it takes to make a great horror film, a sustainable career, a lot of his tips and tricks. He's a really fascinating guy. And so he just kind of unloads a ton of stuff about... what they don't teach you in film school. So
and we also, and we also find out from Sabrina how her first feature film role ever was the lead in this movie, directed by Darren.
Yeah, so quite an adventure. So if you want to check out a little flavor of St. Agatha, we'll have the trailer on our show notes at justshootitpod.com if you want to check that out if you're on a computer already. Or you could even watch the movie. It's out on VOD already.
It's probably also in theaters if you're listening to this the day the episode comes out.
Yeah, correct. So check it out. And if not, we kind of catch you up to speed on everything. But basically, it's about a young woman who, through kind of mysterious circumstances, finds herself at a convent because she is pregnant and is trying to give birth to this baby and becomes locked in kind of a psychological warfare that gets even uglier and more gruesome and scary.
Yeah, none on none conflict.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, before we get into this conversation, it was quite long, but we did want to read some iTunes reviews because it's been a while.
Yeah, thanks everyone.
Some great ones.
iTunes reviews are one of the most important things that you can do to support the show because that is the way that iTunes recommends our show to other people who would probably like it.
Okay. From patron Zach Dalton, he says, perfect for working filmmakers. Love getting insight from these directors. It's perfect for trying to navigate the journey through commercial and other work.
Hey, thanks, Zach. That was the idea.
Yeah. From Saul, a kid from Vegas, he says, it's fun, modern, and all caps applicable, which I think is at least for me, one of the goals of the show. He said, I once heard someone say that if you want to do something, you have to do two things. One, find people who have done what you want to do, and two, do what they did. Just jump, just shoot it. These two dudes don't know me, but should know that they are consistently a source of information for some kid who decided to have dreams. They teach me things that don't come up on Google, things that people on YouTube don't have firsthand experience with. It's well worth the days of listening, and if you have the money, support them on Patreon. Hey. Patreon.com/justshootitbud. I added that part myself. You guys should sell some t-shirts. I'd buy one. And I feel like you read this and you were like,
Should we sell some t-shirts?
Yeah. Okay. If 30 people email us and say they would buy a t-shirt.
I would consider doing like a limited edition run. Like I get that like some people like to own a t-shirt. Or if we have like a cool project, like if it was like, hey, if we sell these 100 t-shirts, then we can send Madeline to the moon.
Yeah. Well, if you're interested in a just shoot a t-shirt, let us know.
Tweet at us.
Yeah, tweet at us.
Or drop it in a review. That'd be even better.
Or make a short film about it. Awesome. From Wowie, the perfect podcast for film students. Maybe one day I'll get somewhere because of these insights. Thanks, fam. Sorry, this is by Nate Did. The review name was Wowie. Cool. And now.
Thanks, Nate.
For the final review with the best title. Not just the Bert and Ernie of podcasts. From the Real Morgasmo.
It really does make me laugh.
A review left today. Just Shoot It delves into commercial shooting as well as narrative like a boss. Behind-the-scenes adventures combined with on-set lessons of not just successful but also disastrous film shoots. There is insight here that you will not find on other film podcasts, and it's a wonderful adventure of two odd couple directors and creative madmen at their absolute best and worst. Thanks for the transparency, the unpaid endorsements, and most of all, the amazing content and guest interviews. You complete me.
Man, what a great review.
I will say the Real Morgasmo like ended the review with you complete me ... ellipsis, which I just think is the worst way you can end the sentence you complete me in an incomplete way. But aside from that, I have no notes. I think it's a great review. No, honestly, it's one of my favorite reviews. So thanks Morgasmo. And I apologize if we've been sending emails to the fake Morgasmo. But yeah. Well, cool. There are a few F-bombs in this episode. Do we need to tell people about that?
Well, I kind of always just assumed that our podcast would be so boring for children
that, like, that they would tune it out. That,
yeah, considerate parents would just put on Planet Money or something that would entertain them even more than our show.
Right, because on iTunes it says clean lyrics. So, just in case you're listening.
Yeah, there's a few F-bombs.
With kids in the car.
Yeah. Yeah, we do talk about horror movies and the things that are in horror movies. A little bit. So if you're sensitive to that stuff, maybe skip this episode or listen on your own.
Well, just one final plug. If you want to support us, patreon.com/justshootitpod. We really, really, really appreciate it. It's just money we use to pay our editor and do live events and get gear and do all that stuff that podcasts need to do.
Yeah, maybe we can just go to the moon thanks to our Patreon.
Yeah.
No worries about t-shirts.
Yeah, why send Madeline there?
Yeah.
We'll go there.
I want to go to the moon.
Okay.
All right.
Now let's talk to some guests. Hey, we've got Darren and Sabrina here. Thank you for coming over.
Hi, guys. Thank you for having us.
Hey.
I want to ask Darren real quick. How many features have you directed?
I don't know. I was trying to think of that on the way over here because someone asked me. I think 12, but 13. Depends. If I count The Devil's Carnival as them, then that's 14. If you don't count Devil's Carnival, then 12, I think.
And this one was number 13, if you say 14.
Wait, I think I've done 14 as in The Death of Me, the one I just finished, is number 14. This would have been number 13. Wait, I'm sorry. So 2, 3, 4. I don't know.
Oh,
it's really bad.
God.
And that's,
in that neighborhood,
I've been very lucky. I did my first film when I was 25. Saw two, I was 25 when I shot it. And I've been able to make a movie a year, and in some cases, two movies a year since I started.
Wow. And are you writing also?
Yeah, I started off, I never thought myself as a director. I always thought I was just going to be a writer. I've sold a few screenplays that I have not shot, but like I wrote Saw 2, I wrote The Barons, I wrote 11-11. And then I sold my script called The Desperate to Lionsgate. And then they made my script, The Desperate, into Saw 2. And they let me direct it. So originally it was just sold as a writer.
Wait, how did they let you direct? Like, were you fighting to direct it? Or were they just like,
yeah. So
also Saw 2. Saw 1 was a surprise, like,
not at the time that I did it. So I'll give you the quick, and I've told the story a million times, so I'm going to give the very truncated version of it. I was in LA. I was a PA. I was on X-Files. I was fired. I was on Van Wilder. I was fired. Every job I had, I was fired. I was terrible. I was a really bad PA.
Van Wilder filmed at UCLA while I was at UCLA.
Are you serious? I was Tara Reid's assistant during this time.
now
I was,
she's your assistant.
I know. I was getting really angry and bitter just about what my job was. My job was to get laundry. It was to fill coffee. I was getting yelled at a lot. And I started writing this script called The Desperate about my desperation in life. I was running out of money. I was running out of options. And so while I was on Van Wilder and X-Files, I was writing the script about desperation. And that script ended up selling, and it was going to be its own movie called The Desperate. That same time, Saw had just gone to Sundance, but it was not huge. I mean, it did well at Sundance, but it was not a hit.
That's so interesting to think. I didn't remember that it was at Sundance.
Yeah, it was at Sundance. And so Lionsgate needed a quick sequel, and they wanted to have it come out the next year. And they knew that to start over from the beginning would have been a huge thing. So they wanted a starting point. And so all of a sudden, The Desperate became a fast track to be the next Saw film. And then,
did you have an agent or anything when you were?
No,
PA'ing?
I didn't. I basically lied and I made up a fake agency and a fake management company, and I made up letterhead and I had an outgoing voicemail. And this would never work today because if you have Google, I made up an agency and I had friends at that time when the sale happened. I was working at APA, and so I knew the inner workings of how things worked. And so I had
an APA is an agency.
Yeah, it's an agency. I had other friends that were assistants all write fake coverage for my script. So there was all this fake coverage circulating on The Desperate, and no one had read the script. So I had people from all the different agencies. And I set up an outgoing voicemail, and I put up a fake name on the script, and I had fake coverage going on the script. So all of a sudden, we started getting calls. People wanted to read the script because they read the coverage. And I did not have an agency, and the script was not finished.
Did you write the coverage and just send it to your friends?
I wrote my version of the coverage and sent it to three other people and asked them to write their own version based on that.
But they hadn't, there's no script.
No. And so then I started getting phone calls, and that motivated me to finish the script. And luckily it worked. And so it was all a ruse. None of it was real. The management company, the agency, none of it was real. And then luckily the script worked and people liked it, and I sold it. And me getting attached to directing was, I was attached to direct The Desperate. It was going to be like a small movie, like $100,000, $200,000, nothing movie. And so my lawyer at the time, when I sold it, I got a lawyer. She made a great addition to the contract that says, Darren is attached to The Desperate or any variation thereof. Well, a variation of The Desperate was Saw too. Mm-hmm. So that was my first in. And then I had to meet with all the execs at Lionsgate. That was one of the most terrifying meetings of my life because I'd never done anything. I mean, I'd done like a bad short film, some bad music videos.
Film school?
You hadn't really even been in many meetings yet.
No.
Right?
Yeah. And I'm sitting...
Wait, you did go to film school, though.
I did go to film school. I went to I went to a place called Full Sail in Florida.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And so I bullshitted my way through the meeting. And I told them that they asked if I'd ever directed anything. I said I've won a lot of awards for my short films. And they said, what kind of shorts? And I said, horror shorts. And this guy named Pete Block goes, Darren, we'd love to see one of those. Can you produce one for us? And I said, yeah, I'll bring it in on Monday. And this is like a Thursday. And so I left the meeting and I called my mom and I was like, guys, I need some money right now. And my parents sent me money and I quickly went out and shot a short film. Joe White, who is the cinematographer of St. Agatha, shot this short film. So this would have been in 2002, maybe 2003. We shot this short film called Zombie. You could actually find it on the Saw 2 special edition. I edited it over the weekend, and on Monday morning, I brought it into Lionsgate, and I got it. So
that is
you always
killer.
Hear stories like this,
that's
and
so
I'm
good.
When just thinking about it, like I'm kind of exhausted. Like,
and I told you guys the truncated 1 second. There's so much more like misdirect and like me doing horrible things to get, but it worked out.
Wow.
Yeah.
So Sabrina, you told me that this was your first lead role
in St. Agatha?
Well,
this is the story. No, you want to hear a coming to Hollywood story that involves St. Agatha. Sabrina, tell your story about meeting me and how you got this.
Oh my God.
That sounded really bad. That sounded really how you got this. Tell the story.
Yeah, I want to hear what you faked and misdirected in order to land in this film.
I didn't fake anything, but yeah, so it's honestly not just the first lead in a feature film. It is my first feature film. I'm from Switzerland. And I moved here 5 years ago. And then 2 years into that, did we meet 3 years ago?
2016.
So yes, 3 years ago. So 2 years into my being in the US, I was just about to, I was on a student visa and then you have to like get the work visa situation. And I was actually like, working with an immigration lawyer, which you have to do to get a work visa. Mm-hmm. And it was super hard. And I just had come out of a meeting that where my immigration lawyer, bless him, he actually did end up getting me the visa, was like, this is not looking good. Like, I don't think this is going to happen for you. And then I'm in my car.
Trump, right?
Yes, it was pre-Trump. I was in my car crying. And then I get a call from a block number. And I don't know why I picked it up. I usually don't. And then a guy on the other end, Darren, says, hi, my name is Ellis Gordon. He always fucking lies.
Okay. But I had a reason for lying, but go ahead.
Okay, yes. So he was like, okay, I'm doing this immersive theater project. It's something like Sleep No More. Have you seen Sleep No More? And I was like immediately hooked because I love Sleep No More. Mm-hmm. And then he said, okay, if you want to know anything else about it, you have to sign a non-disclosure agreement and send it right back. So immediately, still in my car, still kind of crying. I download like a signing app and I immediately sign it, send it back, go home, and then throw on some makeup.
But does Ellis Gordon say like, I saw your name like on a
Ellis Gordon at this point does not even explain to me, I don't think you explained to me how you even got to my name. I'm still a little bit iffy on how you got to my name.
Weird about this is, by the way, I'm going to let her finish the story, but I, your dad's on like backstage or LA casting, you had responded to something from like 6 months earlier. So it wasn't even a recent thing. So you had responded to something like months earlier and you were in the checkbox about maybe call back at some point if it ever comes up. So this call comes like 6 months after you applied for whatever it was that I'm calling you for.
He had a random headshot lying around. He just called that girl and that was me. Anyway, so then he FaceTimes me and in the background is like the Saw poster. And then he's like, yeah, so my name is actually Darren Lynn Bousman.
I actually walk around with Saw posters in my car. If I ever talk to someone,
you have like it's like a doggy cam, yeah. But it's like on your back. You have a Saw poster.
But even douchier is the next line when he goes, yeah, my name is Darren Lynn Bousman. I directed Saw 2, 3, and 4. You can like look me up on IMDb if
that's
you want.
That's not what I said. That is absolutely not what I said.
It's like
IMDb /NM/577. Yeah.
So anyway, I knew who he was because I've been a huge fan of Saul. Actually, for my makeup final at acting school, when all the other girls did something like Pretty and Cute, I did Jigsaw. So then I met with you like the next day, maybe, Darren. And I was supposed to be a small role in the immersive theater project, The Tension Experience. And then the audience had a really good reaction to it and I became the lead of it. And then after that, I got my visa pretty easily, thanks to Darren. And then now here I am.
So now you're on Just Shoot It.
Exactly. So during the Tension Experience, there was one of the line producers of the Tension Experience, this guy named Sir John Stackick.
And can you just give us a real quick rundown of what an immersive theater is?
Oh, there's no quick rundown of the Tension Experience.
An immersive experience
is where the audience is in control of the narrative. They get to maneuver and interact with the world any way they see fit. And so the closest thing I can compare it to is Westworld.
Episode of Girls.
Where they go to an immersive theater.
Well, have you guys ever seen the David Fincher film, The Game?
Sure.
That's what we do. It's the closest thing to what I think we do. Where basically we engage a variety of different people and we begin to manipulate their lives over the course. They have to sign a huge waivers and contracts. And basically the storyline goes 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. In the case of Tension, it went a year. Where basically we would show up at your door in the middle of the night. You would have to get in cars with us. We'd take you to warehouses.
He means me, but yeah, you would mainly be there with a mask.
And we would have...
and you're not filming this.
No. And it was intense. I mean, we had...
So it's not like... Because Matt's wife was in an immersive theater show.
That was more...
Like one night.
More of like a... Closer to a more traditional play.
No, okay, this was
more contained, but...
Like we would, for example, we would do stuff like call spoofing, which means like once we got to know who you were and you filled out the waivers, we ask a lot of very personal questions. So let's say I would know your wife's... What her name was. I would find out her phone number and we would call you and on your phone it would show your wife, but it would actually be us. We would spoof emails. You never knew where we began in your real life. It was a blur. And there was a safe word that you could stop at any time. Extremely detailed, but it was a narrative. It was a storyline and you were following Sabrina's character into a cult. And the end of the storyline was her parents are basically coming to you for help to get their daughter out of a cult. And so there was, 700 or 800 people at the beginning in Los Angeles trying to get her out of a cult.
Like they're the audience.
They're the audience, but they work on their own time. So it literally could be 2 o'clock in the morning or 1 o'clock in the afternoon on a Sunday. You're uncovering this world that we've laid out through the web, through dead drops. Like for example, you'd go to a bench and underneath the bench would be a USB drive. And if you were the first one there, you got that piece of the story.
And by the way, none of this was ever planned out. This is all like on the go. Like literally Darren and I would come up with things maybe like 5 minutes before we would do them. You would call me.
Well, this all ties into St. Agatha.
Do you know about the AI thing?
Or like ARGs, basically.
This is an ARG.
That's an ARG.
Okay. This is what this is.
Yeah.
But we actually ended with we started as a 9-month ARG, but here's where it all ties into St. Agatha. So the line producer of this was a guy named Sir John. The writer of the ARG, as well as the show, was a guy named Clint Sears. She was the lead of it. And when St. Agatha came up to us, it was the line producer that he literally snuck a script into my bag. I hate reading scripts. I've lost out in so many movies because I never read the script.
But I mean, you're not reading scripts because you're at a certain place where...
No, it's not that. I'm just lazy. I've always been. That's why I'm overweight and lost all my hair. I'm just really kind of lazy.
But you're not like... desperate to make a movie, obviously, since I you made a movie every year.
Yeah, I just kind of do what I've been very lucky that up to this point, I've been able to do what I want to do. So he sneaks a script in my bag called St. Agatha. And I just got angry when I saw it because I was like, I don't want to read this. But I opened it and shocking is the only word I can say. Like the original script, the movie St. Agatha that's out tomorrow is very much a drama with horrific elements. The original script was repulsive in a way of such shocking nature. And that's not, the movie was bad. The script was written by three of the producers. You're going to say their names because I always butcher names. Sean Fletcher, Sarah Michaels, and Andy. How do you say his last name?
Andy Demetrio.
And they had a very particular vision for the movie, and it was much more in the lines of Saw. So that's why they wanted me to do it. And I read it, and I was like, this is too much. Like, I have kids now. I can't do this. And so I told them that I would do the movie if I can bring in my writer, Clint Sears of The Tension Experience, to do a polish on it. At that time, Sabrina and I literally, this is going to sound bad, we were almost 24 hours a day, 7 days a week living together because of The Tension Experience. She was in every single scene and she had to be on call 24 hours a day. So I said, the whole storyline of St. Agatha is about a young woman that goes into a convent. And I said, I want this to be Sabrina. I was like, if Sabrina does the movie, I'll do it. And, you know, talk about an uphill battle. You're trying to get an independent investor to allow me to bring in someone that's not only never been in a movie, but she just moved to America. And right. I said, no, this is who it is. This is who I want. And I had her put herself on tape. And the minute she put herself on tape, all the worry went away because they saw that she was the best person for it. But that's how everything came together. I saw Sabrina as the role. Clint and I both wanted her for it. And then we just carried over a large amount of the Tension people into it. And it was the quickest turnaround. We got the script in December and we were shooting in January.
So you basically like auditioned for a year.
Basically, yeah. That's true, yeah.
Wait, let me rewind for a second because I guess there's a lot of things to unpack there.
Yeah.
First of all, you said you're cool with saying anything. So do you get paid for like this ARG? You just spent a year on it?
No.
What's the motivation
to do
that?
Lost so much money. It makes me sad. Yeah. I just want to... Listen, here's the thing. Darren... 12 or 15 years ago is not Darren now. I just talked about myself in third person, but we're going to keep with that.
Sure.
You're on the really podcast. Awful.
It's okay.
I got bored. I did three Saw movies. I felt like I read the best roller coaster first at the amusement park. I'm 25 years old and there's billboards of my movie outside of my apartment, my little studio. I open my door and there's my movie. It was amazing. And I was able to make some money when I did Saw 3. There's a big, I think, a misconception about what someone makes. I made nothing on Saw 2. Literally nothing. It was like...
It was WGA and DGA.
I wasn't DGA. It was shot in Canada. So there's no WGA or GGA. It was not any of those. It was my first movie. It was non-union. So I made...
Even though it's a giant studio film, right?
It wasn't a giant... Yeah. That was the thing is Saw had not come out in the public yet. Saw 2 was a very small movie. Very
small. Was it Lionsgate?
It was Lionsgate, but it was not... Again, first film, first time film director.
Right.
I don't remember what I made, but I want to say it was like between 30 and 40,000. The very first movie I did.
And you don't get any back end?
Nothing. I get zero. So
for
I have no.
Saw 2, which what nothing. They made?
No. So that's what I'm saying is I think that there's a misconception that when people, like, I don't know how many times in my life I've heard, oh, you got that Saw money. No, I have that Mother's Day money, which is a better thing to say than the Saw.
It literally can buy me a Saw.
Yeah.
Like a nice circular Saw, though.
This is an inside podcast, and people want to hear the inside information of what it's really like. When I signed the deal, I had a 2-picture deal. And so you negotiate them both up front. So it's not like Saw 2 opens up and I make a ton of money. It's just like a TV thing. It's Saw, you have a put thing. So that became Saw 3. But
Saw 4.
So right.
You become a billionaire.
No. I wanted to make Repo. And this is where my life, I guess, there was a crossroads. By the time Saw 4 was being shot, I had done two movies back to back. And then I was on my third movie back to back with no break in between. I wanted to do something just weird and crazy. So I wanted to make a rock opera with Paris Hilton. I mean, I don't know how much dangerous you can get than that. there was a lot of leveraging going on about me wanting to make this movie. They wanted me for Saw 4. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until Mother's Day that I actually made money. And not a lot, but... It was the first real paycheck.
Let me ask you this then, maybe, because I think this will help frame things for our listeners. When did you move out of your studio?
Saw 3 when I came home from Saw 3, maybe. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
maybe.
There you go.
The other thing is I never realized how big the Saw films were because I was never here. I was in Toronto. Mm-hmm. They were shot back to back to back. So I would finish the movie. I would edit the movie in Toronto. I would come back for a week of press, and I was back doing the next one.
But you're saying they're selling like Jigsaw masks at the
No, I knew. I knew. It just seemed normal to me because I had no other barometer for it.
You're like, I'm surrounded by this, so I can't tell if it's a big deal or not.
I couldn't. It wasn't until Repo hit and it was a failure that I realized what I had with Saw. I don't know how this all tied into Saint Agnes.
Was Repo with Paris Hilton?
Repo had Sarah Brightman in it. Paris was in it, but it was just a weird mishmash of weird people. Like,
yeah, that movie is bonkers.
It is. It's like Paul Sorvino and Ogre from Skinny Puppy.
Yeah,
and Anthony Stewart Head from Buffy and Sarah Brightman, who's a world-renowned opera singer.
Yeah, it's the sort of, I've seen it like at parties. It's like, let's all get together and watch this movie.
Yeah, sort of it's a cult fandom. It's very much like Rocky Horror Picture Show, kind of cult fandom.
When I assume kind of like from the get-go, that was kind of what you had in mind, right?
I love Rocky Horror, so I wanted to do... I'm a huge musical theater geek, and I wanted to do... And that's coming back to being an artist about these making money. Repo was so creatively fulfilling for me because it was batshit crazy, and no one else was going to make that movie. And it was just awesome that I could... I remember that I went to a party after maybe 6 or 7 months after Repo came out, and I was standing there, and there was these insane filmmakers. There was Quentin Tarantino, and there was James Gunn, and there was all these people. And James Gunn walks up to me, and he goes... I forgot how he said it. He said something like, "You, my man, have big balls." And it was just like going to do a movie like Repo after you're doing the Saw films. And that to me was the biggest compliment in the world because like I want to do cool shit that other people are scared to do. And so that's kind of dictated my career from doing Repo. I've done insane things. I went to Japan for months and months and months and shot a TV show in Japanese of all Japanese people.
Do you speak Japanese?
No, not a single word. I had 3 translators. I went and did an immersive theater experience. I've shot more musicals of just insanity. So to me, that's what's cool. I have no desire just to make the same movie over and over.
Right, and my horror film knowledge is like kind of low level. So was Eli Roth involved with the Saw movies?
Hostel. He was. So we were all. It was funny and not funny. This is what makes me cry when you're saying you're gonna hear me cry in this interview.
Please cry.
I remember one of my earliest memories of like success or seeing a glimpse of it was I showed up to a premiere that Lionsgate was having, and I was standing in the red carpet line, and it was, this makes me so mad. It was Tyler Perry, it was Eli Roth, it was James Gunn, and it was Rob Zombie and I. And we were all kind of just starting out. Like Rob was doing House of 1,000 Corpses into Devil's Rejects. He was doing Devil's Rejects. And Tyler Perry, I forgot what movie he just came out. Eli was on Hostel 2. And James Gunn just said Slither, and we're all like, yeah, we're going to be awesome. We're going to do it. And like these guys have all done like $100 million movies, and I'm still doing $1 million movies and $2 million movies. But
that they read scripts that people give them?
They probably read scripts.
That might be the difference.
That might be the difference. But I've been able to do every passion project that I've had, I've been able to do. Mm-hmm. And I think that to me is cool, is that there's not that movie that like I'm waiting... I don't have that that movie that I'm waiting 20 years to have. I've done everything that I've said I want to make, I've been able to make.
So did you shoot St. Agatha exactly a year ago in January?
2 years ago,
Oh, 2 years ago. Okay. Yeah. So I was trying to do the math. So right before that, you did the ARG.
We've done an immersive theater every single year. So Tension Experience started in 2000. It was all through 2016 and it ended in November of 2016, mm-hmm. where we did the big immersive theater event. The ARG was 9 months leading up to the in-person event. And the in-person event, anyone could go. Anyone could buy a ticket to it. You didn't have to do the ARG. And that stayed open like 14 weeks. And this 50,000 square foot warehouse downtown. Mm-hmm. That closed down. And then the next year we did something called the Lust Experience. And that was very hardcore, like Eyes Wide Shut. You walked into a sex party. And that had an
ARG. It was a real sex party?
Well, not on
Let's just say a lot of penises. I saw a lot of penises that I did not want to see.
There this was related to the cult one?
Yeah,
they all tied in. But the Lust Experience was with the second chapter. It was like, you know what it was American Horror Story. It was the second cycle of us doing these things. Things tied in, but not everything. And then we just finished this year. We did something called Theater Macabre, which was a third year of doing it. So we've done one every year.
How is your wife with your kid cool with you just like
they're not
spending 9 months with like 24 hours a day. Yeah, 20 right? to 2 a.m. Yeah. running yeah. and trying to like kidnap scare people.
Well, Sabrina can answer some of that because she's friends with her, but
yeah, I'm well, not we're actually really good. No. No, but she does really support you and also follow you to places, you know? Like,
well,
is she an artist also?
She was a producer. She produced The Devil's Carnival films with me. She produced 11/11.
And she's a writer?
She's a writer. I mean, she's a saint for being able to put... I'm insane. Like, I'm literally certifiably... I think Sabrina can tell you after working with me for a
yes,
while.
Yes, Laura and I sometimes have to, like, get together and just decompress from Darren.
Usually a bottle of alcohol is involved.
Yeah. Many.
But, right. you know...
But not drinking, just, like, hitting each other hitting, on
yeah.
the head.
Yeah, exactly.
They, this year, I turned 40, like, last month. And they did an immersive day for me where they kidnapped me, forced me to get a tattoo.
Yeah.
I was blindfolded, put in the back of it. They did what I do to other people and they planned it. I think it was my wife's version of just getting back to me. So she does come with me for some of the time. Like I did a film in Barcelona and she was there with me and she loves Barcelona. She speaks fluent Spanish. So she loved going there. And then she went with me to Japan and so did my son. And so it was awesome because I had Henry there and he's like 1.5 at that point. He's getting to go to temples and see all this crazy stuff.
Right.
There's a circus family, I call it, right?
Yeah.
You kind of get to travel around a little bit. And
but and now it's getting harder though because I have a second kid and I just shot. I got hired. Neil Patrick Harris's husband hired us to do an immersive birthday party for Neil. Mm-hmm. So
He has his own kind of immersive game company as well,
yeah,
right?
He's really into this stuff. Yeah. And so he was a big fan of Tension and has been one of our biggest supporters. So we got hired to basically do a 24-hour event for Neil, just like the game, where he never knew what was happening. So I agreed to do it. They moved his birthday party up 2 weeks, and my wife was due to give birth the day that his party was happening. And so Laura is literally giving birth to our daughter. This is not giving birth, and she's pushing, and I'm orchestrating Neil's party, and she's like, "Get off the fucking computer!" And I'm like, "Go now! Send the police! Send the police!" So
you should have kidnapped him and brought him into the labor room.
I mean, that would be incredible.
Then,
because he is a doctor, right?
Yeah, or at least played one on TV. I get a movie called The Death of Me, which is in shoots in Bangkok, and so literally, I have a daughter who's 3 months old, 3 weeks old, 3 weeks old, and I leave to go to Bangkok for 6 weeks. And
she your wife named the movie.
I know. Well. I know Death of Me is really what it is. But she can't travel with a newborn going to Bangkok, which is 30 hours away. So in that case, she's not happy. She is a saint to deal with me. Mm-hmm. I think that and alcohol help her.
Yeah, I feel like I could never... I couldn't swing that.
Yeah.
unless she was the lead of the movie or something, you know?
No, she couldn't. We get in fights on set, and it gets really awkward for everyone around.
Okay, yeah. So let's talk about St. Agatha for a second. So you said it's a drama with horror elements as opposed to like a straight-up horror film?
Depends what review you read. There are some reviews that have been like, this is just exploitative, vicious violence and whatever. And there's other reviews that are
and
like...
And the nunsploitation word that they use, which is not...
Nunsploitation. Yeah,
which is very apropos this week, right? The Pope just talked about it.
Yeah, saying about the women that have been tortured and enslaved to sexual deviancy.
So that was just like a marketing stunt you guys set up.
Yeah, we set that up. We had the Pope in on it. He was very, very cool to play along.
He loves ARG, so...
He does. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, Sabrina, what would you call it?
A psychological thriller, because I would also agree that maybe 70% of the film is more of a drama than it is horror. But then definitely the horror scenes that are in there are, you know, they're worthy of Darren Bousman. Mm-hmm.
There's viciousness. I mean, there is hardcore viciousness.
It's an uncomfortable thing. I think that's what's unsettling. Isn't that girl that gave this really funny YouTube review?
There's a girl on YouTube. I get Google alerts. Like, you know, I had a St. Agatha Google and I got one today and it was like, this girl doing a YouTube review. She's got like a big following on YouTube.
Big following.
And I clicked it and it was I wanted to review every one of my movies. She was so animated and so excited. And she was like, I can't even do it. Like, she was like, it's so scary and so violent and so vicious. And I was like watching through my hands.
And she was like, it says like the most unsettling movie, she said. And I like that word. I think it's unsettling more than anything else.
It's not supernatural. And I think that what separates us from other of these type of films is it's based on real things. It's not based on a true story. We completely exaggerated everything, but it's based on real cases that in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, having children out of wedlock was completely a taboo. It was a social taboo. And our story follows a woman in the deep South who ends up pregnant And she's a grifter. She's a con woman herself, doing these low-level cons just to get by. So it's $20 here, $20 there. She makes the determination with her boyfriend to go to a convent and just deliver the child, and it'll be free. No one will know she's pregnant. It'll be free, and they'll start a new life. And when she goes to the convent, she realizes that the women inside it are also grifters. And it's basically con against con, but it gets really, really uncomfortable in some of the stuff they do.
It's like Matchstick Men meets The Exorcist.
Yeah, that's good. It's good. I never thought I'd hear those two movies put in the same.
And so are you this lead character that is pregnant?
Yeah, the pregnant con artist that then just gets put through the ringer the whole movie, basically.
Yeah, it's got a great ensemble cast of female actresses, but it's anchored by basically two, by Sabrina and this other incredible actress named Carolyn Hennessy. Carolyn is a daytime soap star, won multiple daytime Emmys, and one of the most incredible actors I've worked with, and she is so horrific.
She's terrifying. Yeah,
she's like the mother
of superior. Yeah, and she is Nurse Cratchit from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Looks like a Disney princess compared to Carolyn Hennessy in this. And so it's the two of them going basically head to head. She goes in thinking it's going to be an easy, 6 months, 7 months. Did you, you find out you're pregnant right away, and then you go, so it's a whole nine months you have to be there.
Yeah.
But she thinks it's going to be this easy time, and she's going to coast for free, and then she's going to have her baby, and they can get rid of all these medical bills. But the convent has much different plans, and antics ensue.
Talk to us a little bit about the antics, actually, right? Because in terms of just like the way that conflict expresses itself, like, what sort of horror are we talking about? What sort of psychological games are we talking about? What can viewers kind of expect for themselves?
It gets into body horror a lot. People having to do things that affect their own appearance. It starts off, I don't know if I'd call the movie subtle, because there's some really horrific things that are not subtle, but it starts off, the things that are done are very subtle to them. It's telling them when they can talk, when they can eat, when they can go to the bathroom. And then as the film progresses, it gets a lot more intense than just when you can go to the bathroom. And I think a lot of it deals with humiliation, humiliating them, demoralizing them, dehumanizing them.
And just control.
Yeah.
Because the physical things that they're doing is all about controlling them. Easily controllable.
I'm really curious, Sabrina, when you read a script like this and you're kind of offered the role or put up for the role, are you... like, is it weird? Like, are you like, wait, I can't do this. This is too insane. Like, what's the thought process of like deciding?
I mean, I was so excited. When I read the script, I really, really, really loved it. And he didn't send it to me until he was really happy with it. Like, for the longest time, he didn't send it to me.
Oh, so you guys did a big rewrite on it and stuff.
Oh, big rewrites. Yeah. So he did not send it to me for a long time. But yeah, no, I really loved reading it. But that being said, after I got confirmed from him that I'm going to be the one playing the part, I was terrified. I had like really crazy headaches that I couldn't explain. And then I just realized it was all from being
like stressed out about
doing the role. And because I don't think I was prepared to be, number one on the call sheet on my first film. And then going in and knowing people are going to have expectations from you. And I don't think I ever was too worried about the more like torturous physical scenes because I had just done Tension Experience and a lot of the things towards the end of it, I had to do a lot of things that were really, really emotionally draining and grew and kind of like, a lot of that screaming stuff. So I was like prepared for that. But I think it was more so, the subtleties of it and just like the being on set and not being used to being on set, the rules on set, all of that actually freaked me out more than the role itself.
I mean, I think most people that come into this have had 10 years of working their way up or doing supporting roles, getting bigger and bigger.
Mm-hmm. Being able to watch a star.
Exactly. Sabrina literally comes in and she has 1.5 million lines in the script. She's in every single scene. She has to be there the first one in, the last one out. And every single scene involves her.
And are you the type of director that wants the dialogue exactly as written, word for word?
Well, he does not give a shit.
I don't read scripts. So I'm just like, yeah.
But you did a rewrite on this.
My friend Clint did. My partner who does all the movies and the last 5 or 6 things he's written for me.
But that being said, we all really stuck to.
Yeah, we try. Listen, we I don't want them to walk in and just do a Christopher Guest style thing where they can just say whatever they want to say. We knew what this. We knew what had to happen in the scene. We knew what the scene had to go. If thing, but I'm a. It's in my mindset. If it doesn't sound natural coming off the tongue of that person, I'm not Tarantino. Like I'm not. My words are not as precious because he writes in poetry. His words are the scene. Like that is right. What it
it's
is.
Like iambic pentameter.
Exactly. We're not like that. So if I hear Sabrina say something that doesn't sound right, and I'll give you an example and hope you're okay talking about this. There were certain times that I heard your accent.
Oh, yeah.
And we had to change it because I could hear the Swiss German accent.
Right, in a certain word or a certain
phrase. Yeah, so we'd have to change it.
And it was weird because we could never pinpoint what it was because it's usually actually the melody of how I say something. And so we're both like, we don't know what's wrong, but something's wrong.
I heard it in the movie. The one made it still in is when you said, about I'm worried about our family. Oh, are we doing the right thing for our family? But it was so... It was so accent-y to me.
But it's a period piece, too. So I feel like you have like a little leeway with the accent, right?
Old we English. We did that in post.
I know, but it sounds a little bit. Just a little bit.
Now everyone's going to listen for that. All the people who are now watching.
Are you a multi-camera? Like, how many cameras do you like to shoot your stuff with?
I'm trying to remember. Do we have two? We had two on some days.
But most days it was one.
I like one. And I'll tell you why. Joe White, who is the cinematographer, who I can't say enough great things about. Joe White is literally brilliant. He was the guy I told you I called when Lionsgate said yes to me and I had to shoot that short film. I think he shot 12 of my projects. I've only worked with two other DPs. Him and I both like one camera because I would rather pay attention to one camera and
get one
get one right than try to sacrifice two. Because one of the problem with two is, at least for me, the lighting is not going to be as crisp. Like you're going to have to sacrifice the lighting to make sure that you're not seeing shadows on two. On top of that, it limits you have another camera op, you have another AC, you have another, so the space becomes more crowded. That means less fluidity of movement. I will use two when it's a big gag, but we had one take. So it was just one take, move on, one take, move on.
And do you shoot a lot of coverage?
I do, because I started off as an editor. So I think as an editor and I know what I want, but I do like to have a million options because even this movie we're doing now, The Death of Me, there's three movies, when you start off. There's the movie you write, there's the movie you shoot, there's the movie you edit that ends up being. And a lot of times they're not in
related to
at all.
Yeah.
So, sometimes you find a movie, like we found Saint Agatha in the Edit Room. The way that it's edited is not at all what we shot at all.
So you can tell that, Sabrina, when you watch, you're like,
well, no,
yeah, we had a big change because the script was like, it was linear. Everything leading up to the convent, then convent in like minute 22 or whatever. Mm. And so now it's with flashbacks.
So when that edit started, it was weird to see it.
So originally we did the first act was her backstory, what led her to the convent. The second act was the convent. The third act was escape. Kind of. Yeah. So we were looking at it and the producers rightfully so said, this is boring. Nothing happens until minute 25. I think 25 was the first scare. Mm-hmm. And they're like, you can't do this. So we started minute one, she enters the convent. And then we had all these flashbacks and we had to try to piece the flashbacks together. So now throughout the movie, you have these flashbacks that are kind of telling you what happened. That wasn't the way that it was originally thought to be. So I like to have a lot of like, this is a story. This is a fun story that I forgot about until I watched the movie last night. In the last couple of films, I've got into doing this and I recommend this to any filmmaker who is listening to the podcast. There's always that inevitable point when you get in the edit that you're adding ADR and tons of ADR and you just, I hate ADR. I hate it. I hate putting lines on people's back. It looks fake. So I've started doing scenes, stylistic scenes in every movie that the whole scene is constructed on the lead actor's backs. But I make him look good, and so we shot a scene with Mother Superior and the three nuns when they're smoking, and I had all of it. So Carolyn was Mother Superior is walking back and forth, and she's very like she's very sternly talking, and I knew that I had these scenes with different characters that was shot specifically for ADR, We were watching the movie and we had massive plot holes, and we said let's pull out that scene. The scene was nothing; it was not meant for anything, but we knew we had it.
Like you shot it as coverage.
As basically. Coverage for ADR or to fill in plot points, as opposed to putting an entire monologue on someone's back, we shot a scene to put a scene on their backs.
And when you're shooting that scene, what is the actor saying?
Carolyn
and thinking
is my
and
favorite. Like I want to work with Carolyn for a million years because she is the most hilarious improver in the world. She's like, I got it, boss. And she just talks in the most insane, like rambling, like of a mad woman. I don't even know what she was saying. But each one she would change. So it was like between every cut, let's say we did that scene four times. She had four monologues. They were just batshit crazy.
But she knows that
I told her what it was for. I said this
purely
is
purely for coverage. Gotcha.
I said this is just for if shit's too convoluted and I got to fix it. We're doing this, and I would love to. We didn't have the time in this one, but get one for each character. Mm-hmm. So that was just one character, but there's A, B, and C storylines going on,
and that character is kind of controlling a lot of the plot
lines, so right? I knew that it was most likely going to be on her side.
And a nun, what's the thing? The habit. Like it's so iconic from any angle. That's what like what Handmaid's Tale is so good because you can see them from any angle, and you're kind of there's something you get a sense of stark and tone just from the wardrobe. You know?
So true.
So take that note, guys. Go shoot a scene that has nothing to do with anything and just use it later.
Keep it in your back pocket. Yeah, exactly. That's a good one. We haven't heard that one on the show.
That's genius.
Yeah.
I actually wanted to ask, I mean, speaking of like kind of technical tips and tricks, and I mean, from an acting point of view, I'm interested too, if you have any insight, but like what, and this is a very generic question that might not have a good answer, but like, how do you make a scene scary? What are like some of the...
Yeah, how do you build tension? What's the...
Yeah.
The eyes and the breathing, I think, are important for the actors. Because I also noticed that when we had to redo like the breathing in ADR, it was like, it didn't sound as good anymore, I feel like.
And do you find it scary? Like, is it scary on set or is it not really? Or is it more funny on set? Or?
I thought it would be. I honestly, because I'm a big horror movie fan and I love getting scared and I do get scared. But it was not scary at all.
Not to keep talking about the ARG, but like, I bet that was more immersive and scary, right?
That
like,
was scary.
There's not like cameras in your face quite the same way.
That is why.
I had to meet up with grown men in parks that we didn't really know who they are.
Yeah, sure.
But
he was always there, like in a car hiding.
You're not in danger, but it's easy to be immersed.
Maybe a little.
Darren keeps on bringing eyes wide shut. Yeah.
Well, but that was scary.
I go back is to me, and this is why I'm in love with immersive, and I'll go back and answer your question about tense and how to make things scary, but that's why to me immersive theater is so important to me and why I think it's an important art form is that it's hard. You go see a movie and you are staring at a screen. You are sitting there and you are watching a movie. There's no, in a best case scenario, maybe for 90 minutes you forget. Maybe if it's a really good movie, you forget you're watching a movie. With immersive theater, you blend into the world. You are sitting in a bar. You are drinking scotch. You are smelling the perfume of the actress. She's breathing on you.
It's not quite immersive theater, but even if you go to like, back when I was young and we would go to like Not Scary Farm and people were allowed to like grab you and jump out and you and scare you. And I mean, people were literally getting hurt because people were punching them because they were so scared.
I know.
Like that stuff, even though you know it's about to happen, is like so scary there's physicality in it.
For me, great art is breaking down those barriers so you forget. You forget that you're watching a movie. You forget that you're in a play because it involves more of you. And with tension and with all these immersive things, we try to remove all of the devices that separate you from a real connection. And that was our mantra, is that we want you to be present. And we're not present. We're not. We hide behind laptops and cell phones and iWatches and these, you know, all this electricity that we have. We stop having human interaction. If you allow yourself to have a real human interaction, your emotions are heightened. You become fearful much easier. You fall in love much easier because it's real. It's organic. And I think that I haven't figured out as a film how to do that yet. But with immersive theater, I can connect with people in a way that I could never do in a movie. I could scare them in a way I never have done in a movie. And it becomes a drug because that's why I got into being a filmmaker in the first place. I wanted to tell stories and I wanted to affect people. So with tension, and this is going to sound fake, and I hear it, and I'm like, this sounds like bullshit. I would say when we were running the actual show, not the ARG, the show, a quarter to half the people came out in tears every night. And it was, it sounds fake saying it. And we're talking grown men, not scared. This isn't scary what we're doing. It affected them because they, for 2.5 hours, actually tension was over 3 hours. You were forced to put your phone down. You were forced to have human interactions and talk about things you didn't want to talk about. Mm-hmm. People
open up to me about like their deepest, darkest secrets and would just cry. And then us, the actors, would cry in turn because...
Sure.
So how do you make a scene scary, Sabrina? getting back to that. I think for me, my biggest go-to is... you got to trust the actor to do what the actor is going to do. Mm-hmm. And I think that when you're dealing with someone like Carolyn, she knows what she's going to do. And it's not my place to tell her at that point. If her vision is so different than my own, then I'll go in and I'll say, hey, listen, let's try it this way. But for me, it is the production design. It is the camera movement. And it is the sound. To me, sound is everything. me 15 years ago overused sound design and music. And there's a lot of sound design and music in this. I mean, it's bombastic, but this is also the movie that has the most silence I've ever done. Just long push-ins of nothing. I go back and I watch movies that affected me growing up. Rosemary's Baby is one of those. The long, drawn-out shots of just nothing happening with her folding clothes. You're trying to see what she's doing in that room. That, to me, is scary.
Yeah, that long scene that you changed. There's a scene in St. Agatha that's pretty long where he took out all the sound in the background. It's pretty long, and it's really, you can only hear me breathing. I'm not even saying anything. And that builds the tension pretty well.
Yeah, so I think it's the use of music, and it's the pulling away of music and sound design, which I think really can set up a really scary sequence.
How much do you tell the actors what your intention for the audience to feel is? Like, do you say, like, we want this to be super scary, you know, or are you just kind of talking about what their characters are doing? No.
All that Darren says, literally before every scene, says,
"Don't embarrass me,
Sabrina. Don't fuck this up for me, Sabrina. Don't stand in the way of me and my. Don't stand in the way of my dreams."
No. The only thing standing between me and my dreams is you.
Yeah, exactly.
Also, we only have one take on this one, and action.
Exactly. That's literally what he does.
Every movie is different. St. Agatha, I didn't have to do a lot because we had such talented actors. I have a very clear vision of what I want the movie to be. I edit it in my head. As an editor, I only think of the edit. What's the edit going to look like? And I'll give you an example, and this is something that maybe Sabrina's not going to want to hear. Sabrina might have a great idea, and I'm going to use you as an example. You might have a great idea for your scene that Vaster's so differently from what's on the page or what I want to do. I think of the edit, and I'm like, is what she want to do going to affect how I want to edit the scene? So I will let her have a song and dance soliloquy if I know that all I care about is the look to the left at the end of the thing.
Because that's what I ask for.
So, no, my point is that as an editor, I'm thinking about, will I be able to cut the scene in the way that I see it in my head? Mm-hmm. And then I will give a note if it's so different. There's times like that I'll interject, but for the most part, the actors were so on point, I didn't have to tell them anything. They knew what they were doing. So in that thing, it's more about constructing a mood and an atmosphere. And when you're doing a movie like this, it's just you're running so quick. You're trying to make your days. And I'm not sure if we ever made a day on St. Agatha. I don't know if we ever actually ended early in High Five. And I think it was always like we were like a day behind.
Ever. There was always a lot of tension towards the end of the day. Well, we always went over.
Yeah.
I guess another thing I'm curious about is, like, I feel like in the days, pre-Saw days, there would always be this kind of, like, common knowledge that, like, things happening off screen are scarier than things, you know, like the Jaws kind of right type of thing. But I feel like once Saw and Hostel and all those movies came around, it was kind of the opposite a little bit.
I've started to step back on that myself. I don't want to spoil it, but there's maybe 5 or 6 really gross set pieces in St. Agatha. And half of them you don't see, but they got the biggest reactions in the audience because with sound design, with the reactions.
The performances.
And an edit, right? Like cutting away at the right point. Right?
One of my favorite movies that I've
done.
The
poop sound effects.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm just pushing.
You're all about the poop.
I'm just kidding.
You're going to be so disappointed.
On IMDb, 0 stars, no poop.
I was waiting for it.
One of my favorite films I did before this was something called Mother's Day with Rebecca De Mornay. And it was a vicious script. I mean, it was wrong. And I had a take on it. And the take that I wanted to do was I wanted to take this movie and shoot it like a kid's film. I wanted to shoot it as a G-rated film where nothing was shown on screen whatsoever. And every time that there would be a swear word or there'd be blood or there'd be violence, it would cut away. And to me, we tried it, and it made it infinitely more disturbing, and it made it more hardcore. We ended up doing half and half with that movie, and you'll see if you watch the movie, there are some scenes that we show in graphic detail, and then there are other scenes, and one of my favorite scenes of the movie is a character tries to escape, and Mother, Rebecca De Mornay, puts his wife in front of the husband that tried to escape. And she ties the husband up, and she takes a boiling thing of tea, and she pours herself tea, and there's all this tea still, or this boiling water still in the tea kettle. And she goes, "You don't listen." And she tilts the guy's head, and she puts a funnel in his ear, and you see the thing boiling, and then it pushes past him, and for the rest of the scene, pushes in on the wife. And all you can do is hear him screaming and hear the water going down his ear. And then it's when the screams stop, it just becomes so, and it ends in this really tight shot. to me, it's one of the most horrific scenes in the entire movie, and you see nothing. So I still want to do that hardcore movie, but shoot it like a G-rated film. That's well, my stomach, everyone, if you're wondering what that is.
Yeah, I love that idea. I mean, I get, yeah. Then there's like the Saw movies, you see a lot of stuff.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I keep thinking about, and I actually want to talk about the gags and kind of maybe some of the more explicit things that you do see, because to me, the fun of a horror movie is in getting to do some of that stuff. You know, like there's the VFX, like arts and crafts, kind of like, you know, like how many practical effects are you doing? You talk about the body horror stuff, you know, all of that.
I've never been on a movie outside of Saw that we had time to actually do the gags. You have these great ideas, and I'm going to jump and tell you a different story on a different movie, which more kind of hits the point. I did a movie called The Barons. There's a monster in it. And I had this grand idea what the monster looked like and how he moved. And I wanted to hire a contortionist. And the contortionist had to move in a certain way and hold this mask. And we had, again, like very little time to shoot the movie. And the monster showed up on set the first day. That was it. We didn't see it. We saw sketches before. We saw pictures. Mm-hmm. We saw it in mold. But it showed up on the first day.
Like you've never seen it completely.
I've seen
operated
pieces of it.
Or, yeah.
And this is a costume or like a robot?
It was supposed to be a man in suit, because I'm very anti-CGI when you don't need it. I so much go back to those days that there were puppeteering and there were creatures. So it shows up and it looks great. It looks awesome. And the contortionist is there. And he tries to put the suit on and he falls over. Mm. And the suit was so heavy. It was so absolutely heavy that you couldn't do anything. And so the whole movie is this Jersey Devil. It's running and chasing and leaping in trees and flying. And literally, we didn't have time to fix it. So we put it in a wheelbarrow. And every time you see it, it's only like from here and it's guys in a wheelbarrow pushing it, because it never works the way you think it's going to or you want it to. And we didn't have time to redesign it or pull things out. We had this many days to shoot the movie and that was it. And so the entire idea changed. I find gore that's a big thing in films. The same thing happens, at least on the movies I've done, is that you have these grandiose ideas. And you get on set and you realize to do an actor change. So let's say, for example, there's a scene where in the movie where Sabrina, this isn't a big spoiler, she falls into a bear trap. It's in the trailers. She falls into a bear trap. I know
that
one...
Is that the one that like grabs
her
leg?
Yeah. So... I know for the case of her, we have to shoot, we have one take to do, and then in between the reset, it takes them 15 minutes to reset the bear trap and the blood rig. But at that point, she's wearing all white, so she gets blood all over her. So if I'm going to do another take, she has to go back, and we're in the middle of the forest, so she has to go back 15 minutes to base camp,
sure,
get cleaned up.
It's a big reset.
Yeah, yeah. And then you have, so I'm one artist making the movie, but there's 50 other artists, there's makeup artists, there's hair artists, and they take pride in what they do. That's their art. So I'm going to say, go, 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 get her back here. And they're like, no, her hair is not right. There's blood in her hair. We have to clean her hair. We have to re-put makeup on her. So one gag to reset it could take 45 minutes to an hour. When you're doing a low-budget film, you don't have 45 minutes to an hour. So there was a scene in St. Agatha that part of it was about these girls giving birth. And we had fake babies and we had fake umbilical cords. It never worked, ever. So you just kind of give up and you're just like, we get what we get. We have to get the best version of it and move on. So
were your fake babies like animatronic babies?
No, we couldn't afford that. We just had like rubber.
Do you watch those Alfonso Cuarón movies and just get pissed off?
I see like, them and I just get enraged because I'm like,
where did that baby come from? It looks like a real baby.
Yeah, it's upsetting. But
sorry. Dapper Cadaver.
What's upsetting is our babies.
Is that why you had a real baby? You're like, oh, I just need to make
no,
a real
but
baby.
I think it was funny about our baby, and I'm not even joking you. If I might be wrong remembering this wrong, but we could only afford one baby, and it was an Asian child, but there were no Asian people in the.
This is a real baby.
No, it's about. No, it's a.
You
mold.
Could only afford one.
We could afford
prop
one. We could afford
baby.
One prop over three girls that were giving birth, and it was always the same baby that looked nothing like anyone in the thing. So we had to hide it the entire time.
But it's a super realistic baby.
It, well,
right?
Was it?
It was all right. No, it was cool.
And it's covered with like afterbirth and all that.
Yeah. Oh yeah, it was totally covered in that stuff. It was great.
Strawberry
and I was
jelly,
covered
right?
In it. Yeah. I
always feel bad for the actors who have to kind of like shake the baby to make it look like it's moving and alive.
Oh, that's
yeah, and
rough.
Have to kiss it.
Yeah, that's.
Wait, are you the one that did the Clint Eastwood thing?
I did. Yeah,
American
yeah.
Sniper. Did you ever see that movie?
Oh yes, that was so bad. When isn't is it Bradley Cooper?
Bradley Cooper
who does the. finger. It's weird.
It's so rough. So I did a sketch basically where we recreate that moment, but every time you cut back to it, it's a more fake looking baby. So it's like, you know, it's a super fake doll, and then it's like just a bag of flour, and then it's like a doll that's been painted green, and then it's like the dancing baby from Ally McBeal.
That was so funny.
I so want to tell them about the gag that involves the baby that's like the showpiece thing.
What are you talking about?
The scene.
The little scene. Yeah. Well, I
can. Can I just say spoiler alert and everyone pause for a minute?
Yeah, okay. I would say so. Because every time I hear a spoiler, I'm like, oh, especially if it's awesome, makes me want to see the movie more.
Okay.
Yeah. I will say a lot of our listeners will be like, yeah, I heard, you know, I watched this movie because you talked about a certain set piece and I wanted to see what it looked like. If they know a
scene is hard to shoot, that's more exciting for them.
So I'll give you, I'm going to ruin the movie. It's not really ruining it, but it's ruining
it. It's really not.
So in the script, one of the big things that we had that Clint came up with that I wanted a really unique way to kill one of the main characters. And the whole movie is about these nuns that are taking babies from pregnant women and selling them away from the women. And I wanted something that was iconic and something that related to what was happening. And he wrote a scene that was so repulsive and awesome where St. Agatha or Mary gives birth and she uses her umbilical cord to strangle a nun. And no one thought we were going to do it. And the producers were like, this is ridiculous.
Not even we thought we were going
to
do
like,
it.
And the producers didn't even care because they're like, you got to fix that. We're not doing that. You have to fix it. And I remember it was a week out and Seth walks over and he's like, what are we going to do about that scene?
Wait, why did they want to I mean, it sounds awesome.
Well, because it's kind of comedic and comical.
Okay.
And he's like, what are we going to do? I was like, we'll fix it. We're going to fix it. We're going to figure it out. A couple days come by.
And this is your character?
Her character. Yeah. A couple of days pass and so they go, Darren, we're 4 days away from shooting. It's the last day. It's the last day we're filming. Everyone's leaving to go on planes. You're like, Darren, it's the end of the movie. What are we going to do about this? And the DP, Joe White, comes up to me and Joe's hilarious. He's one of the funniest guys I've ever met. He's like looking at the script and he's like, hey, I'm finally reading the script. And it's like 2 days before. And he's like, are we really going to strangle someone with an umbilical cord? And I was like, we'll figure it out. So cut to, it's like 4:30 in the evening. We're rushing and we had a location move. And if you guys know about location moves, that takes an hour and a half of your day. You're gone. So the sun is setting. Joe looks up at the sun and says, we have 45 minutes and the sun's gone. And now everyone's leaving. It's like
the most important climax.
So it was something out of like a Saturday Night Live sketch. The prosthetics guy comes running over and he goes, I got the umbilical cord. And he's like holding the umbilical cord. And I was like, we're doing it.
I'm the one who read the script.
No, I know. And he goes, right. I go, we're doing it. And everyone's like, we're really doing this. And remember you go, we're really doing this. And I was like, we're doing it. And we had one take and the sun was setting. And like he had to open up all the way to get any exposure in the thing. And
my favorite part is that you made sure that lying there. It was just outside of me. But then he made me like pull it out so you could see me like pull it out of my body. That's my favorite part of it. So you have to watch for that because it's like in the background, but you can clearly see me pull it out.
But this is after it's been disconnected from the baby?
Yes, yes. Yeah, it was
there's
disconnected
a whole big
first.
Scene where they disconnected from the baby. And that's a whole other thing. They disconnected from the baby.
And then it's the
placenta
coming
out. But yeah, then we had one take to do that. I think, well, we had the one and then the safety.
We shot it in January and February. So it's 45 minutes, sun setting. We do the umbilical cord strangulation. And again, it was one of those things that we knew that there was no resets. We would have lost the sun. That we had one umbilical cord.
And so you know that there's some concern that people think it's like a little funny. How do you combat that?
We were worried.
Go all in. Yeah. Just say, fuck it.
What is that?
The actual strangulation.
Oh, yeah.
We go all in. We just say at that point, you're strangling someone with an umbilical cord, they're going to laugh. So fuck it. Let's just do it.
But is your character, was that part of her plan or she realizes she has a weapon?
She had originally.
I had nothing else.
Well, originally there was a fight. There was a whole thing that Bobby King choreographed with like stick. Not Bobby King.
We had our stunt doubles there rehearsing all day.
And like rehearsing with like logs and like shafts of things. And we didn't have time to do it. That's the thing is you go in with this idea, you go in with this. And every day I'd come with a shot list. Like I come in, as much as I hate reading and doing whatever, I come in very prepared. I have a shot list and a lot of times I'll even write what I want the scene to be about. And so I do it for myself. So I know if I run out of time, what's the most important aspect of the scene. Yeah. So like we had a big fight scene that was supposed to take place at the end of the movie and we didn't have time. We had 45 minutes and we had to do just so we cut through all the fight. The stunt people were there all day, had to leave. And we just did the strangulation.
Agatha doesn't fuck around. She just takes the cord and just...
It was great though last night watching it, because you never know how this is going to play. This was the first time I sat with an audience and watched the movie, and it was awesome. Like that, they're like, "Oh no, she's not. Oh no, she is." And then when it happened, you just hear cheers.
But then they just cheered. Yeah, they clapped.
Yeah.
That's awesome. I worked with Bobby King too, and it was the same thing. Like, we'd have these awesome choreographed scenes, and you realize, like, you see the actors do it a couple times, and you're like, it just doesn't. They're gonna have to spend like an hour to make this look good. Let's just,
you know, Bobby
do a way
King,
simpler version of it.
Bobby King, who's a stunt guy. So Bobby King was a stunt coordinator. He started. I first time I met him was on Mother's Day. He was a stunt coordinator on Mother's Day, but he's an awesome actor, and mm-hmm. he was actually
like many stunt people.
Yeah, right.
Well, he's in St. Agatha as one of the two male characters, as an actual character, not as a stunt guy, but as a character. But he was one of the leads of the last two immersive theater, last all the immersive theater experiences. Bobby King played her father in the Titchen experience. He played the leader of the sex cult in Lust, and then was the main guy in Theater Macabre we just did. Is awesome.
Just, I don't know if that matters to you, but the actual stunt coordinator for that day.
No, it's not. I said it was not Bobby King.
Okay,
I
okay, okay.
Nick Decay, yeah. He was awesome.
Wait, so Sabrina, now you were your first movie role is a lead role in this movie that's coming out now, and
yeah.
it's directed by the director of Saw 2, 3, and 4. What's, like, do you get an agent, or what's your next move?
Yeah, so actually, before I got St. Agatha, I did not have any representation. But then as soon as I booked it, his lawyer is actually my lawyer now too, so she did the contracts for me, and now, and she's awesome. And now I do have an agent.
I prepped Sabrina before she took the role, and I said, listen, this is something you need to know. I've had like some of the worst Rotten Tomato scores you could possibly have. Like, there was the last movie I did, Abattoir, demolished everyone in it. And they were just like, this is shit. The people are shit. The script's shit. The directing's shit. And Sabrina is very, all artists, fragile when it comes to certain things. Like, I remember when the Titchen experience, she was very worried about what people thought. And I said, listen, this is not you playing a side character. This is the lead. And I showed her, you went and researched some of Abattoir reviews. And I said, mm-hmm. you need to know that you could be on the front page of Variety and they could tear you apart. They could destroy you. And this is the thing. I used to write a blog series called What They Don't Teach You in Film School. And there's, you know, film school teaches you about lenses. They teach you how to load a camera. And they teach you about linear and nonlinear editing. There should be classes on shit they don't teach you that filmmakers should know.
Sure. Or a podcast.
Exactly. Or a podcast. And I don't know why people are scared to talk about it, but I think I struggle with demons that is never talked about in film school. I struggle with reading reviews and taking reviews personally and killing my morale when I read these reviews, and the way that my mother is in Kansas reading those same reviews because she's Google alerted. And like, there was a review this morning that gave us 0 stars. And it was so mean-spirited, and it was personal attacks. It was so – and then we actually kind of liked it because it was so horrific. It was like – and I said
– Yeah, I was shrugging about it.
But
yeah.
What I was going to say about Sabrina, which is amazing, is – so I prepped her. And I said, Sabrina, listen, you got to know that this is more than just being in the movie. This is – you're going to have to deal with LA Times. Your picture could be up there, and they could say, this is terrible. And so the reviews started hitting about 4 days ago. Hollywood Reporter, Forbes, 30-some reviews have come out, and they target her and say, with a breakthrough performance from Sabrina Kern, with a she introduces herself to the cinema world and not, you know, keep your eye on Sabrina Kern. So congratulations on the amazing reviews right out the gate, which is awesome.
Thank
and I feel
you.
Like you can – I mean, we haven't seen the movie, but even from the trailer, I feel like it look. I mean, the everything is very believable and looks amazing. And
yeah.
Like,
it
I
looks
mean,
too as, scary for
as
me.
As much as you can judge a movie from its trailer, I mean, it looks like a performance-based movie, you know?
Thank you.
It's
no,
not
yeah.
about explosions.
Well, it is. And I said we really lucked out with our cast, but I think that it's
very character-driven, yeah, from everyone. Like, but everyone was so good. It was so easy to work off of everyone else. I mean, these girls and ladies are all so brilliant, really.
Yeah.
But yeah, I was terrified to read the reviews. I was terrified. Terrified of Hollywood Reporter specifically. And then when I read it, I just cried for 10 minutes.
Yeah, because one thing to get a positive review from Hollywood Reporter, it's another thing for them to call you out and say, mm-hmm. you know, with a, I forgot what this, I'm sure you memorized it. What did it say?
No, I didn't. Just like an amazing first feature performance. Oh, impressive first feature performance. And then that everything I did was very believable and truthful.
And that's what's crazy is because like, so you read something like that, it's the discrepancy of reviews. Like there was a review I read this morning that says, one of the St. Agatha's strongest points is the music. And it says the music is intense and it's beautiful and it's haunting. And the guy that gave it 0 stars says, and this music is crap. Whoever got this music is crap.
Exactly.
And so you see that there's, and so who do you listen to? Well, you don't listen to anyone. You just do your shit and hopefully people will like it. If they don't, who cares? Like,
well, so if you're teaching this film school class on reviews, what's the ultimate lesson?
Read them or
don't?
Well,
try not to kill yourself.
Every person that I've spoken to that I've kind of looked up to, and I've been able to talk to some amazing people that I grew up watching and following their films, all say the same thing. Don't read them. It might be easier for them to say that because they didn't live in the age of constant updates and Twitters and tweets. And it's not a real thing. So I think what you have to do is learn to detach. The way that I look at it now is I'm 40 years old and I made 14 films. I'm in the Guinness Book of World Records at this point for having one of the strongest openings in October. And I look at these things that I've done and I'm like, that's fucking awesome. I don't care if you like my shit or not. I'm doing what I set out to do. I set out to Hollywood to be a director and I'm doing it. So sit and write your shitty reviews about me. I don't care. I'm living my dream. And that's all you can do.
I will remind you of that next time a negative review comes in.
Sure. I know. I remember, and this is kind of like where I snapped and my career began. It was not the Saw films. It was Repo. And I'll never forget this. Repo was just destroyed by the critics to a point of almost absurdity, how it was just destroyed. And I remember one afternoon, Ben Lyons had a TV show called At the Movies. And I didn't know this in advance. I saw images of Repo come up and he goes, tonight we're going to be talking about the end of the year, the best, the worst, and we're going to review the new film by the Saw director, Repo, the Genetic Opera. And I told everyone to tune in. My mom, my sister, my brother, my friends.
And you didn't know what he was going to say.
No idea. Comes in and Ben Lyons goes on a venomous rant calling Repo the Genetic Opera not the worst movie of the year, the worst movie of all time. And he was like, this is not, I can't find one positive thing to say about it. It's terrible. It's absolutely shit. No one's going to see this movie. He made a movie without an audience. And I remember the humiliation that washed over my body. And there was the line about there was no audience for this. He said something about there being like no audience for this movie. And myself and the co-creator said, we're going to prove there's an audience for this movie. And I after the couple of days of just shame of knowing that my mom saw this and people saw this, we went to Lionsgate and we got them to give us back the movie and let us, the prints, to go on a road tour. And we toured the movie for maybe 100 different stops. Mm-hmm. I paid for the theaters. We four-walled them and we created a cult community. Repo is still in theaters. Right now it plays at the Vista. It is in, I don't know, 30 cities, double billed with Rocky Horror Picture Show. It is people come up to me on the street and show me their tattoos of Repo. And it's crazy. It's the only movie that in my career that's happened where I get critics taking down their initial review or writing a second review saying that it was so easy to hate. But when you realize what it actually is, in the same way The Room, I guess, that people have now come and realized The Room is this crazy fun cult hit. But I remember I got an Ain't It Cool News guy comes up to me in Chicago and he first watches it, gives it a terrible review. It's a terrible review. I did this road show and he came back out to the road show and saw it with an audience. And he came up to me, he's like, listen, I wrote a shitty review. He's like, no. He's like, I was wrong. And the next day I came in and he had this whole thing on the front of Ain't It Cool News and he was like, this was wrong. He's like, I take it back. Here's what I now say. And it was this awesome thing to watch. But as a filmmaker, as an artist, it destroyed me. And then I realized I got to do something about it. Every movie has an audience. I could sit, I can wallow in my self-pity, I can cry, or I could do something about it. And so we decided to do something about it. We found the audience, we took the movie to them. And now it's probably what I would say I get stopped for 9 times out of 10 over Saw as Repo, the movie that was considered on national TV the worst movie ever made. So,
and you hear that a lot, like Austin Powers was like a horribly reviewed movie. Sure. Ghost, everyone thought was like the worst movie ever made.
Really? I didn't know that.
But now it's like a classic. Yeah. That's because I guess, so I made a movie and I remember the Daily Variety review said the soundtrack was saccharine. And I remember the whole time I was arguing with my composer. I wanted it to like you to feel good when there are good moments. And he's like, it's just so on the nose. Like, why is the music telling us what the story already is? And I was like, I don't know. It just feels good when you have like a major chord or whatever it is. And then we got that review and I was like, yeah, maybe he's right. In my next movie, I don't want to do that. I guess I think you can learn things from a review. If you read something and it resonates with you and you're like, yeah, you know what? They're right. I should learn from that and do something different.
To me, the hardest review is the one that's the most reasonable, right? Yeah. Like when, like maybe you had second guessed something, or you kind of knew in the back of your mind, like, oh, maybe I should do this differently. And then they nail it in the review. That's way worse to me than like someone who's irrationally just decided to go on a rant and doesn't understand what the movie is meant to be.
Yeah.
Right. Like you need to judge a movie on its own terms. Right.
Right. But and I guess so, what Darren says is like, maybe some other reviewer loves the music, sure, right?
Maybe well,
like,
that's so the thing it doesn't. Is
there is an audience.
So again,
and also, you can't care. You can't worry about it.
Well, I pretend like I don't care, but I cry myself to sleep some nights when I read it. I remember one other one, and there's a blog I wrote about this. It's on my website, darrenlynbousman.com. I did a series, like, it was What They Don't Teach You in Film School. I was at Fantastic Fest, and I had a movie premiere on Mother's Day. And this was right in the early stages where I was actually using Twitter all the time. And I remember the movie ended, and credits come up, and I start hearing dings on my phone. And they're still in the theater. Mm-hmm. Q&A has not started. And I pull my phone out, and it was a BlackBerry, I believe. And I'm seeing it. And it was like, God awful. Bousman should hand in his directing card. Right after that, holy shit, Bousman's like, best.
The people are still in the room.
Yeah, in the theater. So they're in the theater.
I see you tweeting, man.
But what happened was, so I see the first two. And then I see the next two, and it's just like, bravo, Bousman outdid himself. And I'm like, and I'm seeing this divide happen with critics that I really respect. And you have some of them are being like, this is shit. And the other people are being like, this is amazing. And then I realized that throughout my career, it's something I've seen that I don't really have. I don't think I've ever made a movie that everyone's like, yeah, that's good, or no, that's terrible. It's always the love it or hate it, the Reba, the Devil's Carnival, these things. And I'm okay with that too. I mean, I would love nothing more than have a movie that critics and peers respected. It's also kind of badass being on national TV, being like, that's the worst movie ever made, and then going down to the theater and seeing kids lined up, dancing, singing, doing whatever. And a caveat to that, sort of a final punctuation, maybe a few weeks later, we're at a premiere, and Leonard Moulton walks up to us and goes, you're the guys that did Repo the Genetic Opera. I liked that film a lot. And in his book, he gave it a great review, and I'm like, holy shit, that's amazing. Yeah. So it just goes to show you.
Leonard Moulton.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so before we go, can you give us two other tips that filmmakers shouldn't learn at school? I love asking for good tips at the end.
Or he's like loved the prescriptive, like the soundbite is his dream.
Yeah, and obviously people can check out your blog at DarrenLynnBousman.com.
Two tips for filmmakers.
The people are like, oh, I read this on your blog and this really made a difference to me.
Well, I'll tell you my biggest piece of advice for filmmakers, and I've said this in the past, I'm going to say it again here. I'm a failure. I have failed 99.9% of the time. I've been fired off jobs. I have had just massive failures in my life, but I got Saw 2, and that was the one success I had. And then I have 199 failures, and then I get Saw 3 or Repo. The difference is not that I'm not the greatest filmmaker of the people that I went to film school with. There were 75% of those kids were better than me. The difference was I stuck with it. And I got kicked in the balls and I said, fuck it, I'm doing it again. I don't care. And I stayed. And the difference is these friends of mine that were extremely talented and extremely like badasses behind the camera, Hollywood beat them down and they couldn't deal with it and they left. And I ducked and weaved and I got a thicker skin and I stayed and then I got these things. So talent definitely comes in. It absolutely comes in. But you have to be willing to fail if you're ever going to find that success. And most people give up. So the first thing I would say is embrace the failure as much as you do the success. For me, at least, if I would have left every time I wanted to, when I was getting fired off X-Files, when Tara Reid fired me, when all this stuff happened, if I didn't stay, I would never be here. I Saw 2 would never have happened with me. I would not be on this podcast now. I would not be talking to Sabrina. So
which is amazing.
So that's number one. The second piece of advice, do what you think is cool. And I think that for me, and this is just my thing, is I've never been able to color in the lines of everyone else. I've always done projects that I like and things that I want to see. And I'm still here. Where a lot of my friends, again, that are more talented than me are going away. And I think that you have to believe in your project more than any other single person in the entire world. And if you don't believe in your project, then how can you ask anyone else to? I will live and die by everything that I do. It might be terrible, but it's my fault that it's terrible, not anyone else's. So I think that you have to believe in whatever it is you do more than any single person.
That's awesome.
Sabrina, I want to ask, do you have any thoughts that you wish you could have told yourself before you were starring in your first movie?
Honestly, I think for me, the biggest thing was, honestly, to piggyback on what Darren said, is the thick skin. Mm-hmm. Because what I, like, to me, the whole getting the audition process was kind of terrifying because, you know, to me, when you hear that a director and director like Darren says, like, oh, I want you to be the lead, first of all, you don't believe it for a few days. But then when he keeps saying it, you think, okay, that, well, that's going to be easy. If the director wants you to be in the movie, that's like, mm-hmm. that's a done deal. And then you find out it's not at all, obviously, because the producers and everyone. And, you know, I think there was a lot in there where with that audition process and with a lot of different opinions about me, mm-hmm. and with Darren already at that point kind of being my friend and showing me emails that mm-hmm. other people didn't know I read. That,
Darren
that
saying
I
things
had to,
like, don't mess this up.
Yeah, exactly. And I had to get a really thick skin for that. But I think it's important as an actor to not take things personally and to also realize it's not you personally, it's you as an actor, it's you as a mm-hmm. business that you have to sell. Mm-hmm. So just somebody saying that maybe they don't want you for something, you can't take it personally, right. even though it sometimes literally comes down to what you look like.
Sure.
And that is terrifying. Yeah. But I don't know. Yeah. Just don't take things
personally.
Just don't
worry
about it.
Have
a thick skin. I still don't. I'm bullshitting here, guys. I'm like,
sure.
So thin skinned.
Yeah. I mean, you, even as a director, when we're not really judged by our looks as much, when you're up for a job and you're not hearing back a couple of days, I mean, the stories that go through my head of what must be happening. Oh, the other director is probably negotiating the rate and they're still holding me to make in case that doesn't work out. Like, you know, I just start going nuts.
Totally. Well, yeah. Or going on set and I thought like, oh, all the other actresses they're going to hate me because they have so much more experience. They're going to be like, oh, this bitch is coming. No experience. Right. She's the lead. What the hell? And it was the complete opposite. I'm sure I also got lucky, but everyone was just cross the bridge when you get there is what I'm saying. Don't worry about it first.
Awesome.
Cool.
Well, guys, this was great. Let's hop into unpaid endorsements. Yeah.
Unpaid endorsements.
I feel like, you know, we talked about this on the last podcast that this year I'm like actively trying to like just have lunches and dinners with other filmmakers. And, yep. you know, since I had a kid, I tend to not go out as much. And so yep. now I realize that it's part of my job is to like go hang out with people. And, you know, I'm meeting someone that lives in like Marina Del Rey and I'm trying to figure out where to meet them in Culver City. Most of you probably know about this, but my new thing is I just go to Eater LA. You know, it's a website with kind of all the best restaurants in LA. And I just like look at it. They'll always have for the current month, like the 50 hottest sure. restaurants of January or whatever. January 2019.
And you can look at a map and be like, oh, well, we need yeah. to meet in Culver City. So there are three great places.
Yeah. So it's always kind of like fun. I feel like you already, like when you're meeting someone that you're a little nervous about, you can already be like, oh, this restaurant's supposed to be good. You already have like all this stuff to talk about.
Yeah.
And it's fun to try new restaurants. And that's how I've been like finding locations as opposed to like asking for recommendations or going to the same place every time. So
yeah, that's cool.
There's also like a little bit of like currency with it. Like, you know, if you're not like a sports guy and like, you know, you're going to be talking about movies with these people already, like having another thing that everybody yeah. can talk about, like restaurants are a thing that I think people
so
are,
important, yeah.
you know, it's very cool to
so Eater LA.
Talk about yeah. food. Yeah.
I love it. Matt, you got anything?
Yeah, I've got one actually that's even more abstract than that. I just got back from Russia and then Prague right afterwards, and it reminded me of how the first Mission Impossible movie takes place in Prague at the beginning. And so I decided to rewatch all of the Mission Impossible movies in a row.
Like all the way up to the last one?
Yeah.
The Tom Cruise helicopter
one? I'm almost done, but what's been really fun about it is I just love having like a some sort of like movie watching project, like trying to watch the entire oeuvre of a director or like wow. everything in a series or something like that. It's like really, it's super fun because like you think of them in a different way, in a different context, and they can be kind of like stupid, dumb popcorn movies like Mission Impossible, or you can be like, oh, like I want to get through, you know, some fancy pants director that you haven't seen all. You could watch every Kurosawa movie if yeah. you wanted to or something. So it's really fun to do that. And it gives you like a little bit more motivation to actually sit down and watch a movie, you yeah. know, rather than just like, oh, I heard this is good. We should watch this next.
I guess the very easy one this time of year is like trying to watch all the Oscar nominees, obviously.
Sure. Yeah. That's a perfect thing. So I'm saying like give yourself a themed movie watching goal.
And then you're not just like scrolling through Netflix and like, eh, this looks.
Yeah, I know what I'm going to watch tomorrow. I don't have to like spend 10 minutes thinking about it.
I just read a book on my way to Philadelphia 4 days ago that's called The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck. Have you guys read it yet? By Mark Manson.
Yeah.
I've seen it, but I haven't read it.
It's actually really good. And because
Is it about reviews, film reviews?
No, but it can be. It actually can be.
Yeah.
But yeah, because I'm the type of person that gives all of the fucks. So literally all the fucks. So I really recommend it. It's cool. It's not, you know, it's a quick read, I feel like, for me.
Yeah, if it's an airport book, I've been looking for one like that.
I don't know how many pages, but it's cool.
Six bathroom breaks.
And I honestly, Darren is going to hate me for this because he's never going to do it, but I really recommend doing the whole 30 because I'm on it right now and I feel really, really good. No sugar, guys. It's
For 30 days.
No sugar, no gluten, no dairy.
No, thank you.
I sound so incredibly annoying.
But you're like in a cult.
I learned from the best.
Yeah. I've recently got into, and I'm driving everyone I know crazy, including Sabrina, I've got into card magic and sleight of hand. There was an Instagram guy named John Stessel who, I love his videos, and I just reached out to him, and he's literally starting to tutor me on how to do sleight of hand stuff. And it's led me down this dark rabbit hole of reading every book on mentalism I can find and every book on which mentalism leads to psychology and psychology leads to whatever. And so what I love about this, and again, card magic and sleight of hands and...
do you know Lior Suchard?
What is it?
Lior Suchard. He's a mentalist, Israeli guy.
No.
He's kind of... Do you know Uri Geller? He was like the guy that would bend spoons.
I know Uri Geller.
So he's like his like protege. And I've endorsed him before because I've just like watched his videos for like hundreds of hours.
So I'm reading this book now called 13 Steps to Mentalism. I think that's what the name of it is. And it's great because I get so wrapped up in my head about movies and notes and reviews. I need something to completely take my mind off of it. And what's great about, this all leads to what my endorsement is I'm learning cardistry, which is how to do things with cards, how to, you know, it's not even tricks, it's how to do things with your cards. And what that does is it's such a tension reliever because I always carry cards with me now. Everywhere I go, I carry cards. And I'm doing flips and I'm doing card breaks and all these things. And I find myself now actually more relaxed than I've been. I'm usually just always on edge. And I live right next door to this place called the Magic Apple, which is a magic store. And I'm like a kid in a candy store. Like I'm a grown man walking in and getting giddy about these tricks.
He'll FaceTime me and just do a quick bit. And then because he's like, and then I said, can you not do it for Laura, his wife? And he's like, no, she will walk away when I start doing the trick. And that's what I want to do. I want to walk away.
You also aren't supposed to repeat your tricks in front of people. Yeah, right?
No, you're like,
sorry, it's a double lift, not a triple lift.
Exactly.
I love the guys that like you're talking to them and then you realize that like your not the watch thing, but like they'll just move things without you noticing at all.
Clint,
you're looking right at them.
One of the writers of St. Agatha, the Tension Experience, we went to the Magic Castle a few months ago and we're sitting in a bar and we're just having a conversation with this guy and I'm commenting on Clint's, he collects watches and I was commenting on his watch and we're talking and we have a single drink and the magician sitting next to us goes, any of you guys have the time? And Clint goes to his thing and he goes, no, never mind, I got it. And he's wearing Clint's watch. Not only did he get the watch off, he put the watch on all the entire time while talking to us. And she's like, that's awesome to me. Like being able to, to be able to misdirect you that much that you're not noticing that your watch is being taken, that he's putting it on, that your watch is even gone for that time. I love that.
Cool. Well, great endorsements.
Yeah, killer endorsements.
So if we want to find out more about St. Agatha's, just Google St. Agatha movie.
St. Agatha. We're in theaters, select theaters. We're on demand, VOD, iTunes, and follow us on the social interwebs.
Social interwebs. Oh yes, Sab Kern. Follow me.
I don't know what any of my things are.
Sab Kern.
You're Darren Bousman.
SabKern.
Yes.
On Twitter and everything. Instagram.
No, I'm so bad on Twitter. I just retweet things. I'm
Darren Bousman on Instagram.
And how do you spell Bousman?
Bousman. And I'm on the Twitters.
We always do fun stories together. It's really great.
My last final point. This is something that made me really happy. Someone, I'll stop it at this. Someone wrote a really shitty comment on St. Agatha. And we get alerts. And I forgot what it was. It was like, it was at a film festival, the film festival guy. Remember how we commented on his posts and we just kept.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
So no, but it wasn't even shitty. No, it was cute.
Fun. It was a good review.
It was like Anna Kendrick.
He goes, but they cast the poor man's Anna Kendrick. And so.
they didn't say poor man. Darren, you're making it worse. It was a good review.
So he wrote the review but it was a couple of slights about Anna Kendrick and you being like Anna Kendrick. So here's the best part. It was foreign and we translated it. We saw what he said. So her and I decided just to comment on it and just be totally cool and being like, yeah, she does kind of look like Anna Kendrick. And then she commented, no, I don't. And then we literally had a thread that was like at least 20 threads deep. And then he just deleted his post and it made us both really sad.
Darren's trying to tell you that we're really funny.
We really are. It was really funny. You wouldn't guess from this interview.
If you follow us on the interwebs,
you can watch our antics.
But it also sounds like if you want to get a message to Darren, director of Three Saws and Repo and St. Agatha.
Just tweet me and I'll
just write a comment on
I'll find it.
Totally.
There you go.
Oh, he's going to see it.
Yeah.
Well, you can find all of their social media links and all of the stuff that we talked about on the show on our show notes at justshootitpod.com.
Yeah, and we're on all the social media at justshootitpod, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. If you have any questions or comments about this, email us at justshootitpod@gmail.com. Leave us an iTunes review if you don't mind. It helps us a lot. And this episode was produced by Madeline Rosewatt. It was edited by Jay McAuliffe. And our webmaster is Ewan Williams. And the music you're listening to is from the Free Music Archive and the artist Jazar. And we will catch you next time.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.